goes nowhere. Crow!
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is actually part two of the musical decades. This is episode 645. It's me and Jason, and we're picking up where the rubber meets the road. Jason timed the last set of notes so we would end episode one of the musical decades in the 50s, which is a good point to break it, because as the 60s begin, just about everything about the culture in America is about to be targeted and psychologically engineered, socially engineered, just in ways that we are going to cover as we can. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And good afternoon.
So I noticed as I went over your notes, you even wrote in to the first bullet point that we're going to cover that this is kind of where things really begin to change in terms of what the music industry does, as an example.
Right. Now, when you get into the 60s, it's still kind of that idyllic America kind of a thing going on. But by the mid-60s, oh boy.
It's crazy. And we're going to lay down the timeline. But I mean, you're opening up with the Everly Brothers. Maybe a lot of people aren't old enough to recognize what that music is. But it is the holdover into the early 60s of that Leave It to Beaver ideal. I mean, how would you describe it?
Yeah, pretty much. The idyllic America. Americana, as they call it sometimes. Just that everything is okay, society is doing well, there isn't a lot of crime, people are able to support themselves. It's the one parent, which is normally the father, going to work to support the family, and they can afford things. And that's the idyllic, like you said, Leave It to Beaver. That's what's portrayed there, and that kind of is the way it was for a lot of people. Not everybody, of course, but a lot of people.
So the change comes on so quickly. That's like with 2020 vision looking backwards. That's what's astonishing, because the way that I recall it, and a lot of that is going to be fond memories, you know, of your childhood and things. That's absolutely going to skew what you remember. But the Everly Brothers is an example. There's like a moral idea under it all. Like, you know, if you go on a date, you're still going to have a chaperone, that kind of Leave It to Beaver morality. How quickly that turns on a dime. And I don't know where you'd put the marker, but I'm saying absolutely post Beatles, when the Beatles arrive, within just a couple of years, so maybe 65 or something like that, that's where I'd put the divide. Where would you lay it down?
Yeah, mid-decade is where you really start seeing the massive shift. And as far as stark differences, if you compare 1960 to 1970, it's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah, let's lay it down. We're going to get there.
The 1960s begins, which is a time that is much of a continuation of what we saw from the last half of the 1950s. In 1960, the Everly Brothers released the song Kathy's Clown on Warner Brothers Records, which is a harmony-driven pop rock hit that tops the charts. Chubby Checker also releases and popularizes the song The Twist on Parkway Records, which is a cover of a song from Hank Ballard and his Midnighters, released as a B-side the year before, which becomes a dance craze that blends the sounds of R&B and pop. Folk music starts to gain popularity, and we see Joan Baez releasing her self-titled debut on the Vanguard label, which is said to introduce protest themes. Folk music will become quite a phenomenon throughout the first years of the 1960s. Surf rock also gets started in 1960, with The Ventures having a hit with Walk, Don't Run. This hit foreshadows the massive success that will shortly be seen when the Beach Boys hit the airwaves. And to top off all of the huge musical events taking place in the year 1960, almost like it was set up to be that way, a band that would go unknown for a few years, called the Beatles, is formed. The decade had also begun with civil rights activism, such as the Greensboro sit-ins and the U.S. presidential election of John F. Kennedy, who defeats Richard M. Nixon. This is said to set the stage for the coming counterculture movement. Youth culture, which is building on the 1950s rock rebellion, begins embracing folk and pop as outlets for social change.
So as we've covered, there was a massive young generation. I think it may have been the largest number of young people in a generation by our reckoning. I'm reasonably sure. But the reason for that is we came out of World War II, where things were tough. We hit the 1950s. As Jason mentioned, there was prosperity. Dad worked. People had homes, cars, everything they needed with one worker in the house. Everything was hunky-dory, maybe the best it's ever been in this country. at least that we're aware of. And they have children, and they don't just have some children, they have lots of children. But here's the thing. These young people are not down with the way things have been, the war culture and all these things. They were truly interested in making change. The system that rose up in music was going to control them. And looking back, it succeeded. It did so many things. Jason mentioned Joan Baez, who she starts out as a folk person, and we'll get there. These are not plugged in instruments. We're still in that morality period. The Leave It to Beaver, you know, is still tinting things. If I remember correctly, either around Woodstock or some other place, she starts talking about her husband in tax jail. So basically, while the drumbeat of war is being played by the government, people like Joan Baez, who I view as an agent of the system, is talking about protesting against that. In other words, playing both sides. We get into the surf rock and things like this. It's a big deal. As an example, the Ventures, I'm not sure, Jason, but I'm pretty sure the Ventures wrote Hawaii Five-0 theme. You think that's right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it is too. It's a big step up in music. It's new. It's an interesting genre. But as we go forward, and the Beatles come to be, which Jason just told you they formed, and either right here where we are or shortly, they're going to be getting trained up by the Tavistock crew in Germany. But we'll move in here, but I'm trying to set the stage for how quickly what was going on was coming to pass.
Now, what you're referring to is what's called the baby boomer generation. And in my opinion, the elite of this world did not see what happened with the baby boomers. I don't think they saw it coming. They didn't fathom that the people, the pretty decent, from a social standpoint, people who went and fought World War II would then want to come home and have an extremely normal life after the horrors they experienced.
Yeah, I think you may be right, Jason. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So what did they do? They came home and they had families, and in many cases, large families. And that's the baby boom generation that so many people like to whine and complain about. Is that's the problem for everything. And they're not the problem for everything. It's the controllers manipulating everything as usual.
Right. Displaces abundance, and we're told the exact opposite. But I think there's some markers that you and I have covered that prove what you just said. As an example, I think it's the 1970s, the first time I start hearing the mainstream talk about overpopulation. And you and I covered when we think the population began to fall. And I marked that in the 70s. We always use Women's Lib as the marker because it's a good marker. When Women's Lib happened, they convinced women they needed to act more like men. They went to work. And instead of starting a family in their early 20s, it started in the early 30s. So we know certainly. And by the way, Estelin's book, The Tavistock Institute, gives you the factual numbers on this. So I think you're right. Just a simple decade after what we're covering here, they're already talking about overpopulation and putting measures to reduce it.
Well, not only that, I think it's one of the reasons they went and blasted out the generation, because there were more of them than they really had thought was going to happen. And then they throw the Women's Lib thing in there to make sure that that never happened again by controlling and breaking up the families.
Right. And the divide and conquer tactics start to show, too. Most people aren't aware. We didn't have the term teenagers before this time. Now think about what's going on in our world. What do we have? We have Generation Alpha, Generation Z. These are divide and conquer tactics, right? When you look at another human being in your country that looks kind of like you or doesn't, speaks the same language, went to the same schools, but they're different because their generation was different. This was not a thing pretty much when I was young. There was the cultural difference of young people respected older people, and there was a dividing line there somewhere. But here, they introduced the term teenagers to start that division.
In 1961, folk music gains one of its prime heroes, at least until he goes electric a few years later, when Robert Zimmerman, more commonly known as Bob Dylan, releases his self-titled debut album on Columbia Records, which introduced folk protest songs like Talkin' New York. This first album of Bob Dylan's only sells modestly, but it won't be long until he becomes a cultural icon. Another folk act, Peter, Paul, and Mary, also form and begin popularizing folk music with harmonies. The sound of Motown also begins to rise this year with the Marvelettes' release of Please Mr. Postman on Tamla Records, which is a soul pop hit song that tops the charts. Motown, which is short for Motortown, which is a reference to the city of Detroit's auto industry, was founded as Tamla Records in 1959 by Berry Gordy Jr., who was a former boxer and songwriter, and officially became Motown Records in 1960. It had started as an independent label that was focused on black artists, aiming to create crossover hits that appealed to both black and white audiences by blending R&B with pop music sensibilities. Soul music, which Motown helped to define and popularize in the 1960s, evolved from 1950s R&B, gospel, and doo-wop, which was characterized by emotive vocals, strong rhythms, and themes of love and heartbreak, and would also include social issues.
So I'm going to try to draw a picture here of what a big deal this is. Motown, taken from Motortown, because Detroit is the motor capital of the world. But what most people don't remember is it used to be said at this period of time, all the way up into the early 80s, because that's where it stopped when they started dismantling Motortown or Detroit, that what was good for Detroit was good for the country. It's hard for an American to recognize what it must have been like to be in other parts of the world to see the best cars and just everything coming out of America. It was the marvel, literally the white knight because of what had happened in World War II. And it was producing Hollywood movies that painted a picture, these cars that everyone wanted. But the thing is, back then, you can't separate any part of American culture from the car culture and the musical culture. Nearly every week, there was music that we still gravitate towards coming new, brand new. Every month, oodles of albums and songs coming out of Motown, coming from the rock, coming from every angle. I actually saw a clip of Berry Gordy running a boot camp for the new Motown artists to make sure they didn't act too black so that the music would sell to white audiences. But the picture I'm trying to paint, maybe Jason can do a better job, is it was in lockstep with culture in America. The music was ubiquitous and it was flowing in at a rate that we've never seen since.
Yeah, totally. Motown's some of the best music ever recorded. It's just phenomenal and absolutely can go for anybody. It doesn't matter your skin color. It's just really, really good, well-done, well-recorded music.
Yeah, and to some degree, it's before the full-on programming. And, you know, we get Bob Dylan and Jason says he didn't catch on at first. Well, he couldn't sing. He's not a good singer. So maybe that normalization had to take place where he became known for the actual words he was saying and to some degree the simple folk melodies he was playing. But prior to Dylan, I can't think of an artist that was on the radio who didn't have singing skill. That is changing as well.
Dylan's vocals were not the greatest, obviously, but he also got in with some other people who were bigger figures from the previous generation in the folk scene. And I'm sure that helped boost him up by him just palling around with them.
When I think about it and I look back, to me, it was the lyrics. They're so packed with so much, and they were aimed at a time when that meaning was amplified. And I think I recently saw an interview where he was asked, how come you don't write the songs like you used to? And he said, I don't know where those songs came from, and I can't do that anymore.
In 1961, in Hawthorne, California, the Beach Boys is formed by brothers Brian Wilson on vocals, bass, and keyboards, Dennis Wilson on drums and vocals, and Carl Wilson on guitars and vocals, along with cousin Mike Love on vocals and friend Al Hardeen on guitar and vocals. David Marks briefly replaced Hardeen from 62 to 63, with Bruce Johnston joining later in 65. The Beach Boys are said to have been inspired by 1950s rock and roll, doo-wop, and early surf music, with the band crafting a sound that is centered on vocal harmonies and beach-themed lyrics. Brian Wilson, who was the group's primary songwriter and producer, was influenced by producer Phil Spector's Wall of Sound style of production, which emphasized layers of instrumentation along with studio innovation. The band is signed to Capitol Records in 1962 and then enjoyed their first national hit with Surfin' Safari, which begins a string of hit singles that reflect the Southern California youth culture of surfing, cars, and romance, which is dubbed the California Sound. the Beach Boys are considered one of the most critically acclaimed and commercially successful bands of all time, selling over 100 million records worldwide. They go on to help legitimize popular music as a recognized art form and will influence the development of musical genres and movements such as psychedelia, power pop, progressive rock, punk, alternative, and lo-fi. There is also a lot of weirdness around the band, most especially with Brian Wilson, who is said to have struggled with mental health issues, as he had been diagnosed as schizoaffective and bipolar. This, along with his abusive father, band conflicts, and drug culture, all exacerbated his mental health issues, which reflected the darker side of the decade of the 1960s.
And there it is. We are in the early 60s, and a couple things Jason just laid down are a big deal. We just heard drug culture for the first time. In the long run, this is going to do as much or more damage to American culture than anything I can think of. When I look back at this period, and I don't know if you're going to agree with this, but I want to hear what you think because you're an audio engineer. I consider that when the Beach Boys arrived and the Beatles arrived, one thing that changed was what could be recorded and how well it could be recorded skyrocketed compared to what we were used to. I mean, what do you think about that statement?
Well, that's a fact. They started pushing the boundaries of what a studio could do. And Abbey Road was actually kind of behind the times with the four-track machines and all those kinds of things. Places in the United States were actually getting the equipment as it was being invented quicker.
The other thing is we were told that the Beach Boys, well, basically Brian Wilson is credited with being the genius, was looking at the Beatles and wanting to emulate and outdo what they did. And we are further told that supposedly the Beatles were looking at them in the same way, although we know something about the Beatles, which would probably make you question because Charles Manson relates into the Beach Boys. But to pull back to my stagehand days, if I'm not mistaken, the band that I ended up working, like I was a freelance roadie. So you would get a call for whatever shows were going around and you might book it a month in advance or a day in advance, or maybe you'd get the call the same night we're short a guy. I think I probably ran spotlights for the Beach Boys more than any other band. And they were doing all these small clubs. And the reason I bring this up is we were doing some event somewhere in San Diego where all these bands were coming. The Beach Boys were headlining. It was small events they were doing. These are not stadiums or arenas. And a guy shows up with a beard, sunglasses in the middle of the night, a hat and long hair. And one of the guys I'm with nudges me and says, "That's Brian Wilson." So I actually did see Brian Wilson. And yeah, he was a strange guy. He was like hiding behind everything I just described.
He just recently passed and was given pretty much the royal honors.
I don't think there's any arguing that he was a musical savant, because if you go listen to even the studio musicians that were hired to be basically hired guns, they all mention him in awe with his musical ability. And quite often, one of the songs that gets pointed to is Good Vibrations.
Now, the Beach Boys is one of the few examples where it was pretty openly known that Brian Wilson was going into studios with the Wrecking Crew and all that and just getting them to do what it is that he heard in his head.
Right. So you're hiring hired guns who come in and do what they do because they're the best. And here this young guy walks in and starts ordering them around. But there's really no arguing with the results. You can listen to Good Vibrations today, and it is just as pertinent as it ever was.
And a lot of times people don't realize this, but they were actually key in pushing psychedelia. Now, the whole happy good times surf culture thing that they pushed early on kind of faded away after a couple of years. And Brian Wilson was writing some pretty trippy stuff.
Right. And I think there was a point where he wasn't even touring with the band. He was staying behind to supposedly write the music while the band was out doing the music.
Well, he was having breakdowns by that point, and I think it was just he was taking care of the music and then the rest of the people involved were going out and performing it.
Make you wonder about the effects of drugs or maybe even MK Ultra. I've read all the above, but I did see him that night and he was clearly fighting demons.
It reminds me a lot of Syd Barrett from the early Pink Floyd days, who seemed to have some mental issues and got into the drug scene. And man, when you have those kind of issues, you just don't want to play around with that stuff.
Yeah, what did they say? He reached for the secret too soon and he cried at the moon.
There you go. In 1963, Beatlemania manifests in the public, a phenomenon that is said to last until around 1966, although the Beatles will certainly be obsessed over for the rest of the 1960s and beyond by many people. The group's popularity had been growing in the United Kingdom in late 1963, being propelled by the release of their singles Please Please Me, From Me to You, and She Loves You. By October, the British press was adopting the term Beatlemania to describe the scenes of adulation that attended the band's live performances. In February of 1964, the Beatles arrive in the United States for their first televised performances on The Ed Sullivan Show, which will be viewed by approximately 73 million people. The band's near-instant popularity establishes their international stature, and their unprecedented domination of the national sales charts will be mirrored in numerous other countries. The British invasion is also considered to start at this time, with numerous UK bands finding extreme success in the United States and elsewhere, along with the Fab Four. The British invasion is said to last until around 1967, and besides the Beatles, would include such bands as the Animals, the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, the Who, and the Yardbirds, among many others.
So my point of view of all these so-called British invasion bands, which doesn't exactly go around every band Jason just mentioned, because we usually only think the biggest of the big were the British invasion, at least I do. But to me, this is all part of the same effort that made the Beatles, trained them up, and inserted them. There is now places you can go to read about the setup to bring the Beatles on to Ed Sullivan. It's not easy to find this information. Ed Sullivan was apparently flown to Britain to prep up for their coming. But by chance, a week ago, I saw a Johnny Carson where the Beatles are arriving for the first time in America. I don't know the name of it, but it shouldn't be that hard to look up. Go look at that Johnny Carson clip if you want to know what's going on. He has zero respect for it. He has zero. You can tell by his knowing comments that he's aware of what's going on behind the scenes, and it's beneath him in a way to talk about it. Johnny Carson, just look up the clip where he's talking about the Beatles coming to America for the first time. But Jason, are you aware of the claims that Ed Sullivan was flown out to Britain to prep up for this?
I've heard that, but I was trying to find any direct evidence to prove that.
It's difficult, which is why I mentioned it's difficult to find. I did see it in print, and I had thought Daniel Estulin had also done something. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure he did. But I didn't have time. I couldn't find it. But to set the stage, the Beatles were set up as a control mechanism. This is my point of view. This is not what you're going to be told in the world. To control the booming young generation who are ready to change things. And we'll move through, but maybe I should clip it there.
There's one more thing we should state, and that's just how important of an effect that the Ed Sullivan Show had at this time. Ed Sullivan came out of the big radio networks, so he had been around for a long time and was a very respected figure in the American public's eye.
Ed Sullivan was part and parcel of American culture once the TV had made it into American culture. He was on near dinner time, and it was different back then because typically families had a dinner time together, and they had an idea called the family hour on TV. What Ed Sullivan did was called a variety show, and it was a show where there might be a juggler, then an animal act, then almost always a music act, and that music act could be anyone from the Beatles to someone from my parents' generation. Could be folk, could be rock, and they were very, very popular shows, but Jason, I think you underscored it when you laid down that 73 million people tuned in the night of the Beatles, but that's not even the part that sticks out about that is I remember that all the young kids that were music buying age, they made it a point to be in front of Ed Sullivan that night. And it was talked about for weeks after the fact.
That's a pretty big number for 2025, but for 1964, that's massive.
That's massive. You want to make a dent in American culture, numbers like that show that you did.
Psychedelic music is called a transformative genre that emerges in the mid-1960s and is defined by its experimental approach aiming to replicate or enhance the sensory and psychological effects of psychedelic drugs like LSD, which was rapidly becoming widespread in Western nations at this time, while also reflecting the 1960s cultural rebellion and spiritual exploration. Psychedelic songs would often break from traditional verse-chorus structures and would use extended jams, modal scales, and non-linear compositions, with tracks ranging from 3-minute singles to 10-minute-plus improvisations. Songs featured unconventional chord progressions, such as modal or Eastern-inspired scales, and melodic experimentation, often with droning or hypnotic patterns that were attempting to evoke altered states. Tempos and rhythms would vary from slow, dreamy ballads of around 60 to 80 beats per minute to frenetic rock of around 120 to 160 beats per minute, with polyrhythms that were inspired by Indian or African music. Lyrics were surreal, poetic, or philosophical, and often would explore drug experiences, spirituality, or social rebellion. Themes reflected the counterculture's ideals of peace, love, and freedom, as well as critiques of consumerism and war. Psychedelic music would incorporate unconventional instruments, such as the sitar, theremin, mellotron, and tape loops for avant-garde effects. Electric guitars might feature distorted, fuzzed-out tones and effects like reverb, delay, and wah-wah pedals. Keyboards and organs were used for atmospheric textures. The drums and bass guitar often provided hypnotic or syncopated rhythms, blending rock with jazz or world music influences. Multi-track recording of 4 or even 8 tracks were becoming available, which allowed layered experimental production, along with techniques such as reverse tape playback, stereo panning, and sound collage. Studio experimentation, which was being pioneered by producers like Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys and George Martin with the Beatles, aimed to create immersive, otherworldly soundscapes. Psychedelic music was driven by a mix of British and American artists, with influences from folk, blues, and Eastern music that helped to shape the sound of the 1960s counterculture.
So to me, the psychedelic music was part of trying to help normalize drug use. And to be honest, a lot of it was, this will be really cool if you put on headphones wasted and listen to it. There are big bands like I associate Pink Floyd. They call a lot of Floyd's early music experimental, but to me, it's in the psychedelic vein. Maybe everyone wouldn't agree with it, but here's the thing about the psychedelic music that I think, I don't even really think it's arguable. They're normalizing the idea that drugs are going to be used and the experience is written about and you're supposed to be high when you listen to it. The music doesn't hold up, not like the music of Motown or other bands we could notice. I mean, if I think right now, Jason, think of a couple psychedelic songs that held up. I can think of a couple, like maybe I think it's called White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah,
and there are maybe a couple Beatles songs, but those are the least popular of the Beatles songs. Can you think of any others?
Incense and Peppermints by Strawberry Alarm Clock.
There you go. Even their names are reflecting that idea, you know, like Vanilla Chocolate, Strawberry Alarm Clock. That's part of the drug usage.
Still a good song, though.
There are a few that hold up, but on the majority, I would estimate that they really don't hold up compared to the other music that was written in that time.
The transistor, which is a semiconductor device that amplifies or switches electronic signals, was invented in the year 1947 by John Bardeen, Walter Brattain, and William Shockley at Bell Laboratories. It was used as a replacement for the bulky vacuum tubes that had been used since the inception of electronics, which enabled smaller and more efficient devices, such as the transistor radio. Early transistor radios started to become available in the 1950s, with the first commercial unit, the Regency TR-1, being released in 1954 by Regency Electronics and Texas Instruments. It was priced at $49.95, or around $500 in today's money. This radio was pocket-sized and battery-powered, and offered AM reception, which made it a novelty for early adopters, which would be those who could actually afford one. By the later 1950s, companies like Sony in Japan introduced models like the Sony TR-55 in 1955, which had improved sound quality but their mass market success came in 1957 with the release of the TR-63. This would lead to the transistor radio becoming the most popular electronic communication device of the next two decades. By the early 1960s, transistor radios were becoming smaller and cheaper, some now as low as $10 to $20 by 1965, as well as more reliable, with improved AM reception and with the addition of FM bands by the late 1960s. By 1965, millions of transistor radios were being sold annually, with over 50% of U.S. households owning at least one by the late 1960s. Portable transistor radios revolutionized how music was consumed, particularly rock music, by making it mobile and accessible, by giving users an anywhere, anytime capability. Transistor radios also empowered teens to curate their own music experiences, listening to British invasion hits and psychedelic music outside of any sort of parental controls. Since prices on units had come down to $10 to $20 by the mid-1960s, transistor radios were now affordable with teen allowances with a bit of saving, unlike expensive home hi-fi systems, which made music a personal and youth-driven medium. This sort of music consumption, of course, would be revolutionized again in the 1980s with the invention of the Sony Walkman cassette player. After that, the notion of portable entertainment was completely a cultural norm.
So in the blog that I wrote for part one, Rose introduced the idea in that blog of format, and she used the 45 record. But what we're talking about here is format. What can we deliver the music on? The transistor radio was a massive deal. And I don't remember the exact date when we got FM. Do you remember when we got FM, Jason?
That would be the late 1960s.
So in the late 1960s, we get FM. There's even a Steely Dan song. I think it's named FM, and it says no static anymore, or no static at all, I think is in the lyric. When the transistor radio came out, there was this little thing, a little bit bigger than a cigarette pack, that you had your music with you anywhere you went. And when FM hit, that static scratchiness that's associated with amplitude modulation, which is AM, went away. And it was as big a deal, maybe not bigger, but as big a deal as when streaming hit, in the same way when the Sony Walkman hit. The only format change that I can think of that was a big deal, but not all at once, was the CD. That seemed to be more gradual. But what we're looking at here is the ability to mass communicate. And the idea that we're talking about here in the transistor radio, I wish I knew the name of it, it's reflected in a movie that talks about this pirate ship in Britain that goes off the coast of Britain to play music to the young. You can probably look it up with just what I've told you.
But it's called Pirate Radio, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Pirate Radio. It's the only reason that movie is a big deal is because all the young people had a transistor radio and they could get away from their controlling parents or other things. But that's a movie worth a watch.
And even Gilligan's Island normalized the concept of the transistor radio because they had one on the island that they were always recharging.
Good point. They even have an episode where Gilligan's tooth becomes the antenna.
The 1970s are upon us, and it is time for another socially engineered shift. With this in mind, the Beatles disband, and several new genres move in to take over the spotlight. The first we will discuss is hard rock, and there really is no greater band in this area than Led Zeppelin. Having released their first album in 1969, Led Zeppelin is now well on their way to dominating the entirety of the new decade. And dominated they did, with album after album being released and doing exceptionally well. They would continue to be a top-tier act until the death of their drummer, John Bonham, on September 25th, 1980, when the three remaining members decided they would not continue without their friend, as he was irreplaceable. The style of Led Zeppelin would be one of the biggest influences for other rock acts, even rivaling the Beatles. Another similar but heavier guitar-driven style of music is pioneered in 1970 with the release of the first album, by Black Sabbath. With this record's release, the genre of heavy metal is born. Black Sabbath would be another group that would see significant success, and even more would come to their lead singer Ozzy Osbourne when his solo career is launched in 1980.
So there's some interesting things that are hit on here. He opens up by saying the social engineering shift. He's spot on the money. And Zeppelin was as big can get. And by the way, they were as big can get as all of the journalists downed them and wrote terrible articles about them and all kinds of stuff. But they were so big, they had their own, I don't know whether it was a 747, but it was a big plane like that. So big that I think in Hammer of the Gods, maybe Jason's read it, I'll ask him. In Hammer of the Gods, I think they end up loaning their Zeppelin plane to the president of the United States. But Sabbath emerges at the same time, and they start getting big. The thing about Sabbath is I don't really think there's anything that can be compared to Sabbath in terms of how hard and dark that music hits with the hooks and the driving guitar and everything else that goes with it. But here's the thing. At the point we're pointing to, rock and roll owned the world. I mean, I know there's a Jefferson Airplane or Starship song saying we built this city on rock and roll, which isn't exactly true for what they're talking about, but it literally is true that rock dominated music in the world at this time. I mean, what would you add, Jason?
Well, that's absolutely true. And while I don't think Black Sabbath themselves saw themselves founding a new genre, the sound that they created with heavily distorted guitars and very catchy riffs, they would be an absolutely massive inspiration for an untold amount of bands that come after. They just had a sound that was unlike any others and a feel that they were getting across that was unlike any others. But it was also in stark contrast to a lot of the happy, happy thoughts that were going on with a lot of the psychedelic and other rock bands at the time. A lot of it was very doom and gloom.
When you put the needle down on Sabbath One, you're holding in your hand a 12-inch album cover with a witch. I think she's in a graveyard, maybe. I don't remember. But when that needle goes down, there is a sense of doom and gloom and darkness as the rain and the church bells come in. And then that guitar that just kind of goes right through your soul. I don't think there had been anything ever published to the public that was in that vein even. It was dark and it was accepted all at the same time. As a matter of fact, when my youngest nephew was coming up and his father was very, very religious, he got in the car one day and he wanted me to play music, but he was too young to tell me what he wanted to hear. So he told me to play The Guy with the Red Helmet. We're thinking, what's he talking about? The Guy with the Red Helmet. And we're talking to him and talking to him. Finally, my wife says, I think he's talking about Iron Man. And then it hit me all at once. He wanted to hear the Sabbath song, Iron Man. But I knew that if I allowed the young person to listen to Sabbath, that would not be okay with his father. So I didn't do it. But that kind of tells you how that music reaches out to grab you, I guess is the point. And by the way, I guess I will mention this. I never ran this, what I'm about to say, down, but I'm reasonably sure there's something to it. It appears that there was a pre-run at the Ozzy Osbourne idea. There was a band called Coven. And if I remember correctly, they had done the original soundtrack for Billy Jack, writing the song One Tin Soldier. If I further remember correctly, at some time, Harper's Bazaar or one of the big magazines that was all over the country in that era did something like out them as witches and Satanists. And it hit so hard, I believe it ruined the band. But that's not the half of it. What I got this from was someone else was doing research. And apparently the lead singer for that band was known as Ozzy Osbourne. And I might not have hit everything spot on, and I'm reasonably sure there is a thread to follow there, but I figured I'd mention it in case anyone's interested.
I think it was their bass player.
You remember better than I do. Do you know if it was Harper's? The magazine was like a Harper's Bazaar or one of these kind of leave it, you know, Better Homes and Garden type magazine that outed them as witches and Satanists.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I haven't looked at that in ages, but it also just seems like it's a nickname for somebody else who also happens to have the last name Osbourne. I don't really put that much into it.
Yeah, and what I've said, it's thin, but when I was looking at it, it was more than I could just dismiss because we are looking at a massive band. that did and create a genre that, I don't know if we consider them the British invasion, probably we do, the impact they made. And what we know of so many of the biggest British bands is they were co-opted into social engineering, that environment.
Having been released in October of 1969, but seeing peak success in January of 1970, the Jackson 5's release of I Want You Back is their debut single from Motown Records, which introduces the young Michael Jackson as a significant talent, with their sound blending soul and pop to create a vibrant crossover hit that epitomized the Motown sound and set the stage for the group's dominance in the early 1970s. The song had what was called an infectious energy, which was merged with polished production and a youthful appeal that helped bridge the 1960s counterculture with the 1970s diverse musical landscape and contributed to soul's evolution as well as the rise of pop. The song was produced by Motown's in-house producers, known as the Corporation, with the music being recorded by Motown's in-house band, known as the Funk Brothers. It was crafted to maximize crossover appeal with a tight arrangement and a polished mix. The Funk Brothers' driving bassline and upbeat rhythm were tailored for radio and dance floors. It was recorded using 8-track multi-track technology, which granted them the ability to do layered vocals and instrumentation without the need to do as much bouncing down, like the Beatles had to do with multiple 4-track machines for their later albums, like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was a hallmark of Motown's late 1960s and 1970s sound. Michael Jackson, of course, would go on to become the king of pop, owning a significant part of the entertainment spotlight for the next several decades. Another huge success for Motown comes the following year in 1971, when Marvin Gaye releases the album What's Going on May 21st through Motown's Tamla label. The album explores themes of war, poverty, and ecological concerns, and is a commercial and critical success, and becomes one of Marvin Gaye's best-selling LPs and a landmark concept album that marks a significant shift in both his career and the musical direction of Motown.
It's hard to communicate to people now how much music that mattered in so many different genres was coming out month after month after month, to the point where in the 90s, I didn't think it was possible that that would ever change. And it sure did change. But when I look back at this, I always remember Michael Jackson coming on TV or some other thing. And I always wondered, these are his supposed brothers. They didn't get an ounce of attention. Everyone was always focused on Michael. And he was the youngest or next to the youngest or something. And it was kind of funny. But here's Motown putting out literally cultural changing music. And it wasn't just culture changing music. It held up. And by the way, later on, if I'm not mistaken, Michael Jackson is going to be credited with producing the best-selling album of all time. I think that still stands, but I don't know. And that would be Thriller.
I think he's considered a co-producer on that with Quincy Jones.
That sounds right. Quincy had his name on so much.
Quincy was also a massive talent, and he also publicly challenged some of the mainstream history of the Beatles.
You know, when you go back and listen to Motown is such a good example, you get the sense of very skilled musicians playing something they love. That's the sense that I get. And when I listen to modern music, I don't get either the sense of either of those things, mostly. Not entirely, but mostly. But that wasn't the thing. The thing was, is there was more of this coming next week, or certainly by the end of the month. I mean, it was just culture-changing music nonstop from what, Jason? Maybe the mid-60s to the early 90s? Something like that?
Well, certainly the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, for certain. Their in-house band, although they did change members out from time to time, were all super talented and super tight.
It's remembered well. It's like when you see a movie like the Blues Brothers, you know, the musicians that they're singling out to honor. Well, that music is being played by people who love that music, who are very skilled at that music. And that's the sense you get when the movie unrolls in the way it does. And that's kind of how I remember Motown. It was a very big deal. And it's a shame we lost such things.
And for the last point for hour one, glam rock bursts onto the stage with plenty of glitter, extreme hair and makeup, coupled with flamboyant and often androgynous clothes, with platform boots in 1971 with T-Rex's album release called Electric Warrior. This style would also be an influence on many rock acts of the 1970s, as well as portions of it being carried over into the 1980s. In 1972, David Bowie began playing his fictional glam rock character named Ziggy Stardust, releasing two albums in this style until retiring the character in 1973. As is portrayed in the title song and first album, Ziggy Stardust is an androgynous alien rock star who came to the planet Earth before an impending apocalyptic disaster to deliver a message of hope to humanity. After accumulating a large following of fans, as well as being worshipped as a messiah, Ziggy Stardust eventually dies as a victim of his own fame and excess. The character was meant to symbolize an over-the-top and sexually liberated rock star, as well as to serve as a commentary on a society in which celebrities are worshipped. He is not wrong. Glam rock's raw electric guitar sound would influence another 1970s musical genre a few years later, but without all of the glitter and funny clothes. And that would be punk.
A very stripped down version. So here we are, Jason, in 1973. I think it's safe to say that at this point in the timeline, sex, drugs, and rock and roll have been normalized successfully, which was part of the intent on the social engineering side of the house. This is the first time that I remember, and I was around when these albums were being released, Ziggy Stardust and others, that gender bending came into the equation. I can't think of an earlier mainstream introduction than this, but I can say certainly that by this time, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were the way things were in American culture. At this time, if you didn't do drugs, you were a square and you were an outsider in almost every circle that mattered. There used to be a little thing that was said to everybody to find out who you were, and that thing was, are you cool? At first, when they started to ask people, are you cool, it meant, do you smoke pot? But by this time, it basically meant, do you get high? Do you do drugs? And that is how quickly the morality that had been so well established in the 50s, going back through American culture, had been seriously changed. I mean, what would you add here, Jason?
So glam rock, in my opinion, is an extreme precursor to the hair metal, hair rock of the 1980s. They took a lot of it and then stripped it down. One band that really stands out to me that was pretty strong in both decades is Kiss.
Yeah, you know, very few people recognize that Kiss was so into making money. I don't know how they got talked into it. They produced a disco album, but I think you're right. I think the David Bowie was the center, in my view, my experience, of the kind of gender bending idea, even writing into the lyrics, you know, mom doesn't know if you're a boy or a girl. That's in one of his songs. I don't remember which. But by the time we get up to the 80s and the hair band is coming, we even have bands like Aerosmith making fun of that with songs like Dude Looks Like a Lady. But I'm with you, absolutely. The astonishing thing to me is we open up in the 60s saying the Beatles are about to be formed. 1963, the pre-planning and everything else that went into it brings them to this country and puts them in front of 73 million sets of eyes. And from that time to a decade later, which is where we are now, sex, drugs, rock and roll, normal in this country. Anyhow, that's it for hour one. Is there anything at all you want to add before I wrap up? We come back for hour two.
Well, we're still in the mid-70s, and there's a heck of a lot more of sex, drugs, and rock and roll to come.
That's a fact. I was there. I remember. Well, at least most of it. Some of it I don't remember. But that has been hour one of episode 645. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. They get access to all the comments and forums. They can create top-level ideas. They can stream the film Shoot the Moon, which is all my prior telescope work, also includes The Discovery of the Second Sun, anytime they want. It has 10 awards in the world. Also, all membership gets exclusive access to my solar work. I am probably, well, right about the same time this comes out, the 18th Solar video will either be coming out or just have come out. And that is exclusive to membership. Also, the images that I make, a lot of people have been getting them. If you do get the solar images and print them, some of them can print huge, like 50 inches, please take a picture and send it to us. With that, we're going to take a short break, get ready for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.